Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains.
The spice expands consciousness. The spice is vital to space travel.
We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or working on your favorite project, you are about to find out more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. In here, the results are always positive. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear, because you will be safely traveling with us. This is a live call-in show, and we encourage you to be part of it. Our phone number, toll-free anywhere in the United States, North America, 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471. Anywhere else on planet or off planet, you can reach us by dialing 530-413-9537. 530-413-9537. If you must get out and about, you don't have to stop listening because you can dial in and listen on your cell phone. 805-399-1000, 805-399-1000. Put it on speed dial, and then comma, which gives you the pause. Put in the passcode 769-608-POUND, 769-608-POUND. And you're in, like a giant conference line. And if you have an Android phone, it's even easier. Just go to our website at x2-radio.com and click on the Android app on the left-hand side. It will download right to your phone, and you're in, just like that. Sorry about missing you last week. I was out in Arkansas. We were doing a film shoot for the next version of a harp documentary, and so much more. You're really going to enjoy it. Produced by Paula Randall Smith, the same producer for Holes in Heaven, which was arguably the documentary that started everything on harp, thanks to Nick Begich, Congresswoman Jean Manning, and others that were involved in that first one. We really appreciated it. The solar wind tonight is 352 kilometers per second, and the proton count is up average 1.6 protons per cubic centimeter. Nothing to be worried about. But it's been so chilly, I don't reckon you guys have been out doing any sunbathing anyway. Earth is entering a stream of debris from Halley's Comet, source of the annual Aquarid meteor showers. Forecasters expect the shower to peak today and tomorrow with as many as 55 meteors per hour in the southern hemisphere and half that number in the north. Although people are reporting fireballs, which is really what we go out to look for anyway, isn't it? The best time to look is during the dark hours before local sunrise, which means you have to get out there around 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. So after you get out of the club tonight, go out and look if you can see it. You know, it's been overcast literally from coast to coast for the last 3 days in the United States. Very, very strange indeed. Very strange weather. We'll talk a little bit about that tonight. Right now, there is a solar tornado on the sun, and it packs a punch. It already launched a CME into space at a blazing 1,300 meters per second, but it is pointed away from the Earth at this moment. Right now, there are 9 sunspot clusters on the sun, visible by the naked eye. although you need some assistance to actually look at the sun. I have never reported so many sunspot clusters at one time on the sun, 9 of them. Many of these are high latitude and reverse polarity. We are nearing a point when an M or greater flare could be triggered and repeated over a period of time, sort of like a semi-automatic shotgun. This may have been the condition of the sun in 1859 when we had one of the most disruptive solar flares in history, known as the Carrington event. Those of you not familiar with that, you can go back and listen to archives of X Squared Radio. There are over 2,000 hours of archives at x2-radio.com. And you can listen anytime you want for $20 a year or $2.50 a month. It's probably one of the cheapest set of archives out there, but my idea is to just keep the lights on here. This is not a living for me. It's a hobby. And to make sure that you get the content, because that's kind of why I have this passion. That's why I'm here every Sunday night. That and your wonderful emails that I get. And those of you that write me know that I write everybody back, each and every person. So if you have trouble with a password that you can't remember or isn't working, or if you simply want to talk about some point or suggest a guest or whatever, just write me, bagnew@x2-radio.com. Well, we're back in the high-speed aircraft business. A lightning-quick experimental aircraft made history this week when it sped more than 3,000 miles per hour above the Pacific Ocean at test flight, reigniting decades-long efforts to develop a vehicle that could travel faster than a speeding bullet, to be sure. The unmanned X-51A Waverider, which resembles a shark-nosed missile, was launched midair Wednesday off the coast near Point Mugu. It sped westward for 240 seconds, 4 minutes, reaching Mach 5.1, or more than 5 times the speed of sound, before plunging into the ocean as planned. Yeah, they meant to splash this thing. The X-51A, built and tested in Southern California, was powered by an air-breathing engine that has virtually no moving parts. It flew for longer than any other aircraft of its kind and traveled more than 264 miles in a little more than 6 minutes. A passenger aircraft traveling at that speed could fly from Los Angeles to New York in less than an hour. However, the airline sporting that aircraft would be broke because they'd have to replace all the windows in the flight path. 5 sonic booms would leave quite a mess. It was a full mission success, Charlie Brink, X-51A program manager for the Air Force Research Laboratory Aerospace Systems Directorate, said in a statement. I believe all we have learned from the X-51A Waverider will serve as the bedrock for future hypersonics research and ultimately the practical application of hypersonic flight. While supersonic flight refers to velocity that exceeds the speed of sound, hypersonic flight refers to going 5 times the speed of sound or more. Since the 1960s, the Air Force has been flirting with hypersonic technology, which can propel vehicles at speeds that cannot be achieved from traditional turbine-powered jet engines. But the technology has been exceedingly difficult to perfect. Previous attempts produced very limited results. In Wednesday's test flight, the X-51A took off from Edwards Air Force Base, slung under the wing of a B-52 bomber at about 50,000 feet. It was released like a bomb and engaged a solid rocket booster that accelerated to Mach 4.8 in about 26 seconds. What a ride. After separating from the booster, the X-51A scramjet engine then lit and accelerated to Mach 5.1 at 60,000 feet. The cruiser's scramjet engine has virtually no moving parts, as I said. The way it works, hydrocarbon fuel, like gasoline, is injected into the scramjet's combustion chamber where it mixes with the air rushing through the chamber and is ignited in a process likened to lighting a match in a hurricane. The X-51A then is designed to ride its own shockwave. That's how the cruiser earned the Wave Rider nickname. After the flight, the X-51A broke up after splashing into the Pacific. There are no plans to recover it. By the way, if you ever get a chance to hear a scramjet, the way it operates, it sounds a little bit like the sky is tearing open. It's not a very quiet machine. While the aircraft was designed to reach Mach 6, engineers said they were happy because the program objective was to prove the viability of air-breathing high-speed scramjet propulsion. This was the last of four test X-51A vehicles originally conceived when the $300 million technology demonstration program began in 2004. None of the other flights went the distance. Looks like they have learned a lesson each time and finally got it where it works. Work on the X-51A was done by Boeing Company's Research Center in Huntington Beach and Pratt & Whitney Rocketdyne in Canoga Park. All told, 370 seconds of data were collected from the experiment. Aerospace engineers say that harnessing technology capable of sustaining hypersonic speeds is crucial to the next generation of, yeah, you guessed it, missiles, military aircraft, spacecraft, and even passenger planes. But you should know that the money comes from military investigations into technology. Aerospace folks down at the Wars R Us at the Pentagon believe that hypersonic missiles are the best way to hit a target in an hour or less. The only vehicle that the military has in its inventory with that kind of capability is the massive nuclear-tipped intercontinental ballistic missile. Other means of hitting a distant target, such as cruise missiles and long-range bomber planes, can take hours to reach their destination. They rely on stealth to get them within range before they are detected, and by then, well, it's pretty much too late. Intercontinental ballistic missiles, however, have a signature the instant that candle is lit, and within just a few seconds, computers can figure out the trajectory. And you can take countermeasures. But with a scramjet, something flying at that low of an altitude, less than 100,000 feet, the curvature of the Earth will protect it. And with a very small thermal signature, not like a rocket or a missile going up into space, turning over and coming back down, much harder to defend against. The Pentagon itself has funded major hypersonic technology programs over the last several decades, most notably with the X-15 rocket plane that was built by North American Aviation and flew a half a century ago. Over the last 10 years, the Pentagon said it spent as much as $2 billion on hypersonic technologies and supporting engineering. For now, there is no immediate successor to the X-51A program, but the Air Force will continue hypersonic research, and the successes of the X-51A will likely find its way to the high-speed strike weapon program, which is currently in its early formation phase. DARPA, good friends down at Wars R Us, otherwise known as Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, has made public its best guess about what might have caused its unmanned arrowhead-shaped hypersonic technology vehicle, the HTV-2, which was launched last year, to suddenly lose contact and crash into the Pacific just a few minutes after slicing through the sky at Mach 20. This was last August. Evidently, it was going so fast that its skin peeled off. After an 8-month investigation, DARPA concluded that even though the HTV-2 was expected to lose some of its skin mid-flight, larger than anticipated portions of the vehicle skin peeled from the aerostructure, sort of like a flying crash. The agency said it expected the HTV-2, which goes so fast it can make the commute from New York to Los Angeles in a whopping 12 minutes, to experience impulsive shockwaves at such speeds. But shocks it experienced last August were more than 100 times what the vehicle was designed to withstand. While the test was very public, the details of the HTV-2's design, stability system, and potential purpose, well, they remain highly classified. 2 months after DARPA's test, the Army tested its own hypersonic aircraft. This one, a long-range weapon system called the Advanced Hypersonic Weapon, the AHW. It was designed to strike any target in the world in just 2 hours. Should President Obama want to strike any target in the world from the homeland in just a couple of hours, that capability will soon be at his fingertips. Kind of gives the whole idea of drone strikes a whole nother dimension. Instead of something sort of lurking up there waiting for the bad guy to poke his head out, where he can be hellfired to his virginous destination, we could take out a small town of people mobilizing or moving in the sea or on land within a couple of hours, and we'd only need to have one base for the aircraft. So let's change speeds just a little bit. By the way, if you've just joined us, our phone number tonight is 888-429-5471. We'll broach any subject tonight that you want to talk about. I have noticed, as have you, that we are experiencing some weather strangeness. I've heard other hosts talk about this here and there, and they kind of touch on pieces of what's going on. I would say the mainstream media is kind of happy with the idea of global warming. And there is the alternative media who believes that, you know, climate change is upon us. I think I'm in that camp pretty much. And somewhere in between or overlapping both camps is the notion or the possibility that man's activities may have something to do with it. Late season winter storm Achilles has battered the heck out of the Great Plains, Rockies, and Midwest with a vengeance, dumping record snow in some towns while dropping temperatures to record levels in others. It'll go down in history as one of the greatest snowstorms so late in the season for the Midwest, said weather.com meteorologist Chris Dolsey. Wisconsin, Iowa, and Minnesota may have set new state snowfall records for the month of May. Snow was reported in Arkansas, for the first time in recorded history during the month of May. I hate to tell you this, but Sunday I was in Arkansas, and it was about 68, 70 degrees. The sun was shining, not a cloud in the sky. Trees were greening. Birds were birds. And it was beautiful. And here we are 5 days later, and it's snowing like crazy. A winter weather advisory was also in effect for parts of Minnesota, Wisconsin, and the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. Snow fell in parts of Nebraska, western Iowa, received as much as 10 inches of snow by Thursday morning. Denver, Monday, 18 inches. The storm was welcomed in Colorado and Wyoming because, of course, it boosted the snowpack that provides the region's water supply. It also greatly helped out the ski industry. Both states are in a drought, but have benefited from several rounds of spring snow. However, the recent storms have largely missed southwestern Colorado, which remains dry and at risk for wildfires. Yeah, the mountains there are a little high, kind of hard to push over with any kind of moisture. About 5 inches fell near Denver, where the snow was making the roads a sloppy mess. The snow wasn't sticking much to the pavement. Still warm after recent temperatures in the 70s, but it did cling to the grassy areas and flowers. And when it melts, it goes right into the streams, which fills the rivers, which fills the reservoirs. Nancy Keller of Owatonna said her three kids were getting fed up with the endless winter. She said several of their tennis, soccer matches, and field trips have already been postponed. Oh, excuse me while I reach for a tissue. They're getting tired of having things canceled, Keller said. Such was the sentiment in other states that also got slammed by the two-day storm, which dropped a wintry mix of snow and rain Wednesday from Oklahoma, Kansas, Colorado, and Wyoming into Nebraska, South Dakota, and Iowa. It delivered the first May snowfall in Sioux Falls, South Dakota in 37 years, knocked out power to tens of thousands of homes and businesses in several states, forced the closure of major roads, and was a factor in at least one fatal crash early Thursday in Wisconsin between two semis on Interstate 94 near Menomonee. Now, there are some crazy things going on with the weather, and there are also some crazy claims going on out there about the weather. One of the more famous physicists that steps outside his normal area of expertise, he's kind of like the Einstein of our genre, because he likes the camera, and he's a news contributor. And I'm going to play a short clip, and then I'm going to comment on it, because this is kind of what the mainstream weather alarmists are saying. And I want you to pay close attention, because there are several sort of buzz points that I'm going to address here. This is my good friend Michio Kaku. Just listen up. Well, okay, hang on just one second. That doesn't seem to be coming through to you guys, and I'm not exactly sure why. Because normally when I play something on there, it comes out. Let me see if I can do something about this. Yeah, normally when I play something on the computer, it comes straight out and you can hear it. Hold on one second. Let me switch this switch back to stereo. Now, let's see if it'll play now. I'm not exactly sure what's going on. Yes? No? No. No sound. Okay. I can hear it. You can't hear it. And that's really strange. So I have to figure out something to do there. Maybe I'll figure it out after break. Let me see if I can send the file to the studio, because normally, I have no trouble doing this at all. It just comes right out, and we don't have any issues at all. Let's see if I can find it here. Go into my scripts and see, there it is right there. Okay, let me stick it in here and send it to the studio, and they'll play it for me. And then we'll both listen to it. How about that? Little short clip, and we'll get that one going. It's downloading right now. I'm going to send one more file to him, which I'm going to play later, not to be played right now. All right, I'll send this one to there. All right, we got about 30 seconds, and then it's going to come up. My good friend Michio Kaku is a good mainstream commentator, and I applaud him for getting out there in the public eye and at least making people aware of science, especially the advanced stuff. But from time to time, he seems to voice the alarmist point of view. And I want to make sure that you know the difference between that. I don't know why that's going to take about 10 minutes to get to the studio, so I'll talk about something else and we'll come back to it. That really kind of harshes my gig. I don't know why it's doing that. Normally it plays out of this just fine. I suppose I should start putting that stuff in my iPad and then it'll come right out. The real facts are that glaciers are the big argument. Some of people say that the glaciers are shrinking all over the planet, but the fact is, the actual factual measurements are that all the glaciers around the planet are actually growing. Some people say that the average temperature of the planet is warming, that the last 10 years, 11 years have been the warmest that we've ever seen. That's not really, let me cancel this one file. Maybe the other one will speed up. Oh yes, it sped up a lot. That'll shorten it a lot. We'll get it to you in about a minute now. So what is the truth? I mean, I've visited the glaciers in Tibet, and yes, they have retreated in years past. They're back thousands of feet from where they were, but they're growing at the rate of 3 to 5 meters per year, pretty steadily, pretty reliably. And of that, there can be no question. We also look at the ice in Antarctica, and it has been growing. In fact, it's growing at such an alarming rate that occasionally it will calve, sort of like a cow having a calf. It will calve pieces of itself off the size of small states, and then that will float around and reattach itself or go floating off into warm South Pacific waters and melt away. Some people have said that what we need to do is go down and grab one of these calves when they come off, because we're talking about, a 20-mile piece of ice, which is a whole lot of fresh water. Grab that 4-mile or by 20-mile or 10-mile by 20-mile piece of ice that comes off, put some motors on it, and, put that thing up off the coast of Southern California, park it out there somewhere by Catalina, and we're talking about enough water to supply Southern California, all the cities in Southern California, for about 5 to 6 years, maybe 10 years. So that's a lot of water, and it's a lot of fresh water. It's the best water that you can get. It's clean. It would be renewable, and it's just going to go melt off into the Pacific Ocean anyway, which most of it will run downhill to the Pacific Ocean without any issues anyway. So it's a good idea, and a good investor should grab one of those big calves, throw a couple of 5 or 6 big diesel motors on that and just run that thing on up off the coast of Southern California, anchor it, and start hooking it up. And besides that, you could sell tourist trips out to it. You could go snowmobiling on it or skiing on it, during the summer even, because believe me, only a small part of the iceberg itself is above the water. The rest of it is below the water. And it could be isolated or insulated pretty well, that you could preserve that ice under the water for a long time. The Pacific Ocean is not very warm. It gets up to about 73 degrees in the summertime, but it's quite chilly in the wintertime. It can get down in the high 40s, low 50s. Believe me, I've gone surfing in it, and it's no fun. Even in the summertime, it's only because it's 100 degrees on the beach does the water even feel good. It's not like summer in Florida at all. So we've got less than a minute. This file will be live. I'll get the heads up from the studio that it's ready, and then we'll play Michio Kaku, my good friend and colleague, and we'll let him say his piece, and then I will counterpoint with him, try to bring this back into perspective for you so that you don't get too alarmed. Yes, we're involved in some of the global warming, but mostly the pollution that we're putting into the air is not the heat-trapping emissions that would change planets. It's more the toxic chemicals that have their effect on the microscopic level, which cascades through the food chain to, well, to us, actually. And we're more or less polluting the planet with other chemicals that are laced into those fuels and various other emissions that we're pumping into the atmosphere and also into the water supply and into the soil. We need to stop doing that. Water bottles and styrofoam cups and oil and different chemicals that we dump in our landfills, paint and so on, all of that has its effect, very long-lasting effect on the environment. Oil, not so much. You know, crude oil is pretty natural, and if you spill it on the ground, nature has a way of taking care of it pretty fast. Even bacterially will consume all the oil. I've been at the site of three phenomenally major oil spills. I'm talking spills so bad that it literally filled a valley with oil so deep that you could row a boat across it, higher and deeper than the corn or any of the houses in a valley. And yet you can go back to that valley today and you could dig and plant and fish and anything you want in that area, and there's no pollution whatsoever. I've also been on the white beaches of the Gulf Coast, and I've watched them dig down with a backhoe down 25 feet as they were laying drainage pipe for some of the streets. Not a single fleck of oil anywhere in the sand on those beaches. Well, let's go ahead and play Michio Kaku's piece, and then we'll be right back. It's about 5 minutes long. We'll just let him say his. Go ahead and play it.
And here to recap some of the major events of 2012 is Michio Kaku, a physics professor at the City University of New York. Good morning. Nice to have you with us.
Mm-hmm.
You look at the weather patterns over the last year, and they all seem wild, extreme. What was driving that?
Well, when you look outside, you say the weather's on steroids. But there's no single aha moment where you can say, aha, this is what's driving the whole thing. But what you can say is that the Earth is heating up, which means more moisture is going into the air. And when moisture collides with cold air from Canada, watch out. That's what's driving hurricanes and tornadoes and droughts and even forest fires in Texas, for example.
So the Earth has never been this hot before, as hot as it is now.
This year could go down as one of the hottest years ever recorded in the history of science. The last 10 years goes down as the hottest 10 years ever recorded in the history of science. And that means more wacky weather, more moisture, more energy. Global warming is a misnomer. It should be called global swings, where we have flooding in one area, forest fires and droughts in another area simultaneously.
Which means the world doesn't end tomorrow. It's just every little event is incrementally worse or more significant than it was before.
That's right. When you look at the larger trend, you see something disturbing. All the glaciers on the Earth are receding. You see the fact that the North Polar ice caps has diminished by 50% just in the last 50 years. An area the size of the United States in terms of ice disappeared this year over the polar ice caps. The seasons are changing. Summer is longer, winter is shorter, tropical diseases are moving north. All the indicators show that the Earth is warming up, and that's what's driving some of this wacky weather.
Does that foreshadow then more extreme weather in the future, or could we snap back?
Get used to it. We could be experiencing more 100-year flooding, storms, and hurricanes because there's more energy circulating in the planet Earth because the Earth, on average, is heating up. Now, we can argue how much human activity is driving it, but everyone agrees the Earth is heating up, there's more energy in the system, and that means more swings in the weather.
No matter who's contributing to it, more swings. We certainly saw a swing just a couple months ago when Sandy came in, Superstorm Sandy. It wasn't technically a hurricane when it hit shore. Talk about Sandy a little bit. What happened? What came together for it to happen? And whether something like that is likely to happen again soon?
Well, that $70 billion storm exceeded even the 100-year projections of New York City. And one of the reasons is the Caribbean and West Atlantic is about 4 degrees warmer than normal. And that's the energy that drives hurricane, warm water. And because the Caribbean is hotter than normal, and because it collides with cold air coming in from Canada, that's what drove the energy that devastated much of the Northeast.
So when you look forward to next year in your crystal ball of weather, what do you see?
Well, no one can predict the future. However, what you can say is we're going to experience more swings, more wacky weather, more 100-year storms, perhaps. Get used to it. This is the new normal.
Is there one type of weather event, by the way, that becomes a little more extreme than others, tornadoes, hurricanes, whatever else, or is it just everything is affected?
Everything on average, because it's the collision of two large air masses, one from Canada coming in, cold air from the jet stream, warm air coming in from the Gulf of Mexico. It's the collision of these two air masses that creates Tornado Alley, that creates many of the thunderstorms and determines the weather over the United States. And these weather patterns are now being affected on average by the warming of the earth.
Professor Kaku, thank you so much.
All right, so that's Michio Kaku's take. Now, he said that the oceans are 4 degrees warmer. Yes, that's true, but only the top 30 feet, you see. It's just the depth that the sun's energy goes. The rest of the water underneath the ocean is the same temperature it's always been. It hasn't changed much at all. Now, when it comes to the surface of the planet, what really absorbs energy is the ground. Water doesn't change temperature very easily. The sun's rays only penetrate about 30 or 40 feet into the water. The infrared energy is lost almost, you know, in the first 3-4 meters of water. So you're going to get some warming. If you don't believe me, just snorkel a little bit. You'll feel it when you dive down to about 20 feet. You're going to feel that icy layer just underneath. That's about the extent of where the sun's radiation gets. And there's not much turbulence between the surface of the ocean and, you know, a few yards underneath the water. That's why when you scuba dive, it's nice and calm down there. You get a little bit of bobbing, but that's about it. Because there's not much mixing between the top of the water and the bottom of the water, unless the tide happens to be going in and out and there's some topology to the bottom of the sea where you have currents that are pushing up toward the surface and rolling that water over. Deep ocean, you really don't have that problem. So it is inaccurate to say that the ocean's 4 degrees warmer. It really isn't. It's only the top 30 feet. Also, to say, you know, that we've experienced the hottest weather in the last 10 or 11 years. Let's put it in relative terms. We're only talking about 1.5 degrees over that period. Is it enough to change the surface of the planet? No, not really. But what we really have seen, and I don't think he expressed this very well, is we're not talking about global warming. We are talking about global extremes, however. Not swings, but extremes. In other words, the winters are colder with more snow in most areas, and the summers are hotter. Last summer, we broke 3,000 heat records in the United States. The year before that, we broke heat records in Russia. And this year, we have the longest, coldest spring and winter that we've had in a long, long time. As I said this week, the entire nation was covered in cloud cover from coast to coast. Never seen it that way. I flew from the East Coast here in Charlotte all the way to Bentonville, Arkansas, and I did not see the ground until we got to the point where we had to go below the clouds. So what that does is it prevents the infrared, that's the portion of the sun's wavelength that transfers heat, that's somewhere around, oh, between 900 and 1,000 nanometers. That temperature, that wavelength is blocked by the clouds. It's absorbed way up high, 20, 25,000 feet. Not much heat gets to the ground in that case. The ground does not warm up very much. You can tell this by simply walking out on the asphalt in your bare feet. You'll notice that on a cloudy day, you can walk across the street with relative comfort. But on a bright sunny day, you're going to have to run by the time you get to the white stripe in the middle of the road, because the black asphalt of the road absorbs a lot of infrared energy from the sun. So much so that even on a day that's only 80 degrees, the asphalt can be upwards of 110, 120 degrees, which is not comfortable on bare feet at all. That's how the planet warms. The sun doesn't heat up space. That wavelength travels across space, goes down through our atmosphere, and strikes dry land. That's what makes the planet warm up. At night, you can see the thermal signature of the dry land because it is radiating that heat back up into the atmosphere. You don't believe me? Try renting a convertible in Phoenix sometime and then go out driving after midnight in the summertime. When you pass under an overpass, you will feel the heat that that overpass has absorbed all day long. It's still radiating that heat after midnight, as is a good testament from all the dead armadillos in the middle of the night on the highway. So if you have high cloud cover or cirrus clouds, which is the very high stuff that you see, or the thick clouds, which are the cumulonimbus, the kind of billowy, puffy clouds that you see that sunlight doesn't make its way through very much, kind of puts goosebumps on you when you're on the beach and one blocks the sunlight. It also does that on the ground. So when we have a lot of weather, when we have a lot of cloud cover, we don't have a lot of global warming. When we have no clouds is when the sun's rays go straight down to the ground and heat it up. Now, some people say, well, that's why they're doing chemtrails, you know, to run these kind of crisscross patterns up there with aluminum and strontium and different things like that in the air to kind of deflect the sun's rays high up 20, 30,000 feet to keep it from reaching the ground. Well, you know, sounds like a smart idea, but, you know, tough luck proving it. Somebody made the comment today, they actually sent me an email with a film and said, yeah, now they're starting to use commercial aircraft to lay down the chemtrails. No, they're not. Okay, the FAA is extremely picky about what is put in that fuel. That fuel is tested every single day. There's a sample taken of that Jet A. That sample is delivered to the FAA lab every single day, and they test it for specific gravity and cleanliness. We did the same thing in the Air Force. Every single day, that fuel is tested. And no commercial pilot that I know, and I know a lot of them, both former pilots and current pilots, would stand 1 second, would not put up for 1 second, their equipment being used to spray anything like that in the air. Now, I'm not saying there aren't military aircraft up there doing it. I have seen plenty of pictures of commercial aircraft turning it on and turning it off. Unless those videos are just completely photoshopped, okay, I am a believer. But in these skyways, and a skyway is like a highway in the air, they're the same routes every time that these pilots take from one airport to the other. If they're flying a regular route between cities, then they get used to that route, and it's within a quarter of a mile, give or take, because of the weather and different altitude routes. It's the same all the time. They fly the same nav aids, the same navigation aids every single time. It's part of their plan. So I don't think for 1 second that that commercial aircraft are being used to spray chemtrails. You could prove me wrong. And if you want to call me and tell me I'm crazy and that you see it all the time, the phone number is 888-429-5471. We can talk about it. But for sure, it is a very strong political football. Now, let's look into the EPA's findings a little bit. Its annual report detailing greenhouse gases shows that those releases fell by 1.6% between 2011 and 2012. That's because of reduced emissions from electricity generation on account of Obama has been so hard on coal-fired power plants. He's been switching the coal plants over to natural gas. Those figures are consistent with what the U.S. Energy Information Administration has reported, which is that carbon dioxide emissions fell by 2.4% between 2010 and 2011. They are also 9.1% less than in 2007. The EPA, though, focuses on methane, which is the most potent of the six greenhouse gases. But methane's lifespan is about 20 years compared to that of carbon dioxide, which is, it's 100 years. The EPA has said that the amount of methane that is leaked into the atmosphere during the production and piping of shale gas has fallen by 20% from 1990 to 2010 because of tougher regulations and better equipment. They put scrubbers in place, which electrostatically gather those gases and prevent them from going up the stack. And they also fine the heck out of them for what we call fugitive emissions, which is where, you know, like if they're changing a valve, what they'll do is just leave the pipe open while they're replacing the valve. Now they have to have two valves so that they can replace one of the valves. It's reasonable to expect drilling practices will continue to improve and that leakage rates will continue to go down, says Michael Schellenberger, president of the Breakthrough Institute in Oakland, California. He says, this should be treated as very good news by anyone concerned about climate change. Well, I have my hand up. I'm concerned about climate change. A Cornell University study conducted 2 years ago concluded that total greenhouse gases over 20 years as a result of exploring for shale are at least 20% greater, possibly as much as double when compared to those of coal. That's because natural gas is composed mostly of methane, which is CH3, which may have the ability to dissipate but is still capable of trapping more heat than carbon dioxide simply because it's a bigger molecule. Now, that being said, sticking around for 20 years as opposed to 100 years, it's only chemically true. And I'm just going to throw this in here because, you know, we have a lot of botany on this planet. That is to say, we have a lot of green plants and we have a lot of algae. And green plants that are growing, that is to say, trees that are shooting out new leaves or saplings that are growing or grass or algae or crops, all consume carbon dioxide. That's true. They take the carbon from the carbon dioxide and they combine it with sunlight and energy, which the plant manages in its respiration process called photosynthesis. And it synthesizes sugar, which is also made of carbon. So to say that CO2 has a lifespan of 100 years is accurate, but CO2 is consumed in the photosynthesis process, whereas methane is not. Methane hangs around as methane. It just hangs around as methane, unless it's oxidized by combining with oxygen or other free radicals, and it's oxidized into something else, which doesn't really happen once it gets up to high altitude. Once it gets up to high altitude, it's not going anywhere. It doesn't react with anything. So Generally speaking, the methane hangs around for 20 years as methane, and nothing consumes it. But the carbon dioxide is consumed and is necessary in the respiration process, photosynthesis of plants. So it's unfair to say that carbon dioxide hangs around for 100 years. That really depends on if it gets eaten or not. All right. So at the same time, peakprosperity.com's Martinson is saying that the estimates of retrievable shale gas deposits are vastly over-exaggerated. I might agree with him on this. Geologists are projecting those to be 100 years or more, but the author says that the demand for natural gas is so great that the current reserves will amount to 30 years at most. The large greenhouse gas footprint of shale gas undercuts the logic of its use as a bridging fuel over coming decades. If the goal is to reduce global warming, says Robert Horvath, a Cornell University ecology professor and lead author of that study, we do not intend that our study be used to justify the continued use of either oil or coal, but rather to demonstrate that substituting shale gas for these other fossil fuels may not have the desired effect of mitigating climate warming. I'm not sure that I agree with him on that point, because the efficiency of burning oil or coal or gas has been greatly improved, both with catalysts and with aspirating systems. That's the ability to get air into the combustion process. And, to be able to hold the heat inside the furnace, which is used to make the steam, which turns the turbine, which makes the electricity that you enjoy in your homes. Also, the ability to manage the plant. The plants are being modernized all the time. As you know, when the sun goes down, the demand for electricity drops by, probably 70%, especially in the summertime. And as such, you kind of cut back a little bit on the coal that you're throwing on the coal bed. But the way these furnaces work is they have a moving chain conveyor. It's sort of like a giant metal mat. And air can come up from underneath it and from on top, and that's where the coal burns. You slow the chain down, and you keep tossing coal on top of it, and what happens is the coal burns and creates ash. The ash makes a layer between the chain conveyor and the coal that's actually burning. It allows you to insulate the chain from, being consumed in the fire, because the coal can actually get quite hot. So you want a coal bed of several inches thick, sometimes 6 or even 8 inches thick. And the burning coal is actually on top of the chain. So at the front of the chain, where the coal is being broadcast out, or if it's a fluid bed, that is to say a fluidized bed, not water, where the coal is ground kind of fine and then sprayed out over the coal bed so that complete combustion occurs. And by complete combustion, I mean you don't get carbon monoxide, you get carbon dioxide. In fact, we measure those with infrared lasers in the stack so that we can make sure that the burn is complete. Then there are catalysts in the stack, and there are scrubbers in the stack that take all the little coal fines out of the smoke and soot, and we collect those and actually use them for other things. It's called carbon black. We use it for making highways and all kinds of tar products and paint and different things like that. It's useful. Completely burnt up carbon. The other thing is that we want to emit carbon dioxide, not carbon monoxide, and that's monitored pretty carefully. And now we use low sulfur coal so that we don't put so much sulfur into the atmosphere, which can form acid rain. We keep the stack temperatures up above 350 degrees Fahrenheit, because if it drops down below that, sulfuric acid will actually condense inside the stack. That happens to be the evaporation, the boiling temperature of sulfuric acid. And if it condenses inside your stacks, it will eat the stack up, and you'll end up replacing it prematurely. So at those temperatures, we make a little bit of hydrocarbon, not so much nitrous oxides, and we just keep everything nice and hunky-dory where we keep the emissions as low as possible. So coal is not that bad of a player. However, natural gas pretty much burns up to carbon dioxide and water. You don't get as many BTUs out of it, but you know it's so cheap, especially in the South, that it doesn't cost as much to run it. Coal has been made quite expensive by policies of this administration, and so natural gas is used instead. So our usage of gas has gone up because we've replaced coal with it, and that may be putting a burden on the shale gas. Now, what's shale gas? That's a really good question. When we drill for oil and gas, sometimes we drill into volcanic structures. Most of the time we drill into what are called sedimentary structures. They exist in the ground as petroliferous zones, like layers, sometimes 2 feet thick, sometimes 20 feet thick, and different, you know, measures of porosity. That is to say, it's either gravel or sand or solid rock. If it's solid rock, good luck. You're never going to get anything out of there, even if you frack. If it's sort of rocky, you can fracture it with pressurized acid and create passageways for the oil to flow to the hole. And if it's sandy, then you've got a situation like tar sands, and in which you use liquid propane or something like that to solvate it and bring it to the hole. It used to be expensive, but now gas and oil is so expensive that it's worth its while to do it. Now, shale, on the other hand, is kind of a layered flat rock. It is a sedimentary formation, but it's highly porous. Not so much for oil, but really good for gas. If the zone is very thick, then you have a lot of natural gas to flow to the hole. Historically, at least from my experience as a geologist in the field, remember I drilled 55 oil wells in 9 states using my exploration technology, which, by the way, can tell the difference between shale and a regular petroliferous zone. Shale gas is typically not terrifically high pressured. That is to say, it's not 1,200 psi. It's usually 400 psi or less. We consider this low pressure gas. And if it's near a pipeline, you can just hook it up to the pipeline. It will flow to the scrubbing station where it is scrubbed and passed along down the headers, where it's distributed down your neighborhood at somewhere around 5 psi, so pounds per square inch. So it's nice and safe by the time it gets to your place, and sulfur is added back to it to kind of give it that rotten egg smell, because otherwise you wouldn't be able to smell a gas leak, and we'd all have a problem. And that's basically how it works. So it takes, in other words, a lot of volume, a lot of square miles of shale with gas connections, wells, in the right place in that formation. And how they tell the volume is by the flow rate through the hole and the pressure. If the pressure begins to drop, if it starts out at a 400 PSI well and a year later it's down to 300, a year later it's down to 200, you know that your reserves are limited. Eventually, that well is going to get down to less than 100 pounds, which means you don't have a lot of gas left. You better start looking for another formation. We're at that point with some of the gas. But I would say we have at least 30 years or more of shale gas reserves out there. So, it's become very political. And there's been a lot of money, a lot of lobby money flow all kinds of ways to make sure that regulations are in place that aren't too confiscatory as far as fines and taxes and things like that, to be able to bring this fuel to the power plant so that it can make electricity for you. And this has led to increased investments by such producers as Anadarko Petroleum, Chesapeake Energy, Cabot Oil, You know, there's just a lot of big, big investors. It could also bode well for those with extensive pipeline networks like Kinder Morgan and Williams Companies. These are the big pipeline managers in the United States. With all of that added activity, industry has concentrated on cutting methane leaks during discovery and transportation, as well as the building of state-of-the-art power plants, which have reduced overall emissions, as I said. That some people are clinging to outdated leakage rates suggests they are more interested in slowing the coal-to-gas transition than in slowing global warming and reducing air pollution, says the Breakthrough's Schellenberger. Unlike many regulators, the EPA has steadfastly maintained its independence. And if you believe that, I've got some beachfront property in Denver that you need to buy. Its latest findings, which it says are evolving, which means they're still counting the money, will assuredly give shale gas a shot of energy. And, I think natural gas, for what it is a lot cleaner to use than coal. But, you know, I've burned a lot of coal. I've burned hundreds of rail cars of coal in three different boilers at the same time, and I can tell you it can be done cleanly. It can be done efficiently. I have ridden the controls of those boilers like a bucking bronc for years, and I can tell you it can be done. So, it's right at the top of the first hour. Let's go ahead and take a quick break, and then we're going to get further into this. Oh, it is going to get heated. So, I might have to have you wear your seatbelt at some time in the next hour, because you're probably going to want to stand up and throw something. But that's okay. That's okay. That's why we're here. We're just trying to get your energy up. Let's take a quick break. We'll be right back after this. Don't go away.
Hallelujah. tried to touch. I told the truth. I didn't come to fool you.
Welcome back to X Squared Radio, our second hour, May 5th. Jody, Alana, and Morgan with Hallelujah by Leonard Cohen, one of my favorite songs out there. Done it a few times. It's a hard song to sing, hard song to really have feeling with out there, and sometimes the voice cracks a little bit out there. We're glad that you're here with us tonight. Our phone lines are open anywhere in North America, 888-429-5471. Anywhere else on planet or off planet, you can reach us easily at 530-413-9537. Now, there has, as I have said, when we're talking about energy and we're talking about global warming and we're talking about climate change, the last of this segment, the president has had some pretty sly attacks using this political football. The new year did not mark a clean slate, I can tell you that. Congress and the president will reconvene their hostilities on a regular basis. And while the impasse will prevent legislative action to fix the level greenhouse gas emissions, the president is nevertheless preparing a more insidious attack on climate change. Re-election to the White House is giving President Obama the oomph he needs to tackle the effects of global warming, a topic that has been legislatively off limits. To achieve his objectives, however, Obama is remaining persistent and is pursuing a high-tech, clean-tech economy in conjunction with his administration's recently enacted environmental regulations. Addressing climate change is urgent, says Michael Schellenberger, you know, the author of that last study I read you, and he's president of the Breakthrough Institute, an environmental think tank based in Oakland, California. Energy transitions take a long time, and we need to get started. I couldn't agree more. When President Obama took Washington's reins in January of 2009, he inspired me, and his party controlled both House and the Senate, but he was unable to enact a cap-and-trade program to reduce the level of heat-trapping emissions. Well, you say that's what cap-and-trade was used for. It was actually creating a new currency, a new dollar based on carbon. Never got off the ground. Mostly because of all of the fraud that was involved in it. Oh, yeah. Certification agencies popped up right and left. People were issuing this certificate and that certificate. It was supposed to be a tradable item that startup companies that were generating clean energy technology could use to get funded. Well, guess what? Yeah, none of the money ever materialized. Just never came to be. Never got started. So there was so much fraud and so much graft and so much subterfuge in the whole system that it just consumed itself. And now it doesn't seem like anybody can get it started. Anybody even mentions the word cap and trade, people immediately run for the door. Nobody's interested in talking about it, and definitely no investors are interested in funding it. And that's pretty much where it sits. And it's a sad thing, because a lot of these technologies are breakthrough technologies, and they could actually use the money. They actually could use the money and make some great inroads with that money and introduce some new technologies. But that is not what happened. What they call the opposing party, which is the Republican Party, which regained the U.S. House 2 years later, promised to block firm cuts in carbon dioxide releases. Conservative lawmakers will acknowledge that global temperatures are rising, but say that such a phenomenon is a natural occurrence, not man-made. Any solution, they add, would require universal participation, and that signing any protocol without such stipulations would economically disadvantage the United States, and that is true. You see, global cap and trade worked out so for the United States. Keep in mind that the credits, excuse me while I take a sip of my wonderful grapefruit juice, just hold on. You see, it wasn't a level playing field. Let's take the amount of greenhouse gases that the average half-ton pickup truck puts out in a year. Well, if you do the calculations based on, let's say 17 miles per gallon. You do the calculations based on 17 miles per gallon, and you total up all the CO2 that truck can generate in a year in the United States, and it's worth $250. Now, folks, it's not even worth filing the paperwork to get $250 back on the greenhouse gases that a Ford half-ton pickup truck is going to put out in a year. Not worth it. However, that same truck in India, same emissions, same fuel, $2,500. Ah, now that gets to be pretty hefty. If you've got a fleet of, let's say 1,000 trucks, well, that's $2.5 million. That's worth filing some paperwork under. Not in the United States. It's only $250,000. Who wants to even mess with the paperwork? You can't even hire the two people it takes and put up with the hassle of the government bureaucrats to get your check. So it isn't even worth it. And that's why the Republicans were against it. Not because it wasn't a good idea. It is. I mean, if we're going to be using up the atmosphere by pumping carbon dioxide, then by rights we should pay a use tax, which is really what it is, folks. It's just a pollution tax. But unfortunately, the United States was disproportionately penalized. And the interesting thing is that a half-ton truck in the United States pollutes about one-tenth of what a truck in India pollutes. So we should be getting a much better return on the investment than India. However, not to be deterred, the president then sought reforms after the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that carbon dioxide could be regulated under the Clean Air Act if the Environmental Protection Agency concluded that it was harmful to human health and the environment, which, of course, he didn't have any trouble getting. Obama's EPA made that exact endangerment finding that has been upheld by the federal courts, because the agencies are very, very careful about how they file their cases in court. They engineer it very carefully, stack them in the correct order, and they know they're not going to lose because each case lays the precedent for the next one. And so they very carefully escalate this over a period of years until they get this endangerment finding to the point where they can really apply some leverage. Now, no new coal plants can be constructed at all in the United States unless they would capture carbon dioxide releases. We call that sequestration. No, it's not like the sequestration that you're hearing on the news. That's a different sequestration. We're talking about carbon dioxide sequestration. How do you do that? Well, you have to bubble the gas that comes out of the stack through salt water. And the carbon dioxide coming out of the stack can be sequestered in the salt water. Now, I made a proposal about 3 years ago. Let's see. No, wait a minute. Yeah, 3 years ago to the undersecretary of the EPA that we could take the carbon dioxide that's been sequestered in the salt water. Instead of pumping it down into mines where it would be stored for, I don't know, till the end of time, we could take that salt water and we could pump it into lakes. No, not lakes like you would fish. I mean man-made lakes that would be greenhouse lakes. They would be managed by growing algae in the salt water. Yes, and what would happen is the algae would take the CO2 out of the salt water and they would grow on it and they would become nice and fat. And by fat, I mean fat with oil, real oil. And then the algae could be collected and they could be separated from their oil, which could be collected and used for all kinds of stuff because it's a high omega-3 oil. It could also be used to make fuel, like jet fuel, and it could also be used to make diesel fuel. And the remaining protein actually is a very high protein that can be used for chicken feed, pig feed, all kinds of animal feed because it's very, very high protein and good for you, high omega-3, the top stuff that you can get. So, unfortunately, the undersecretary was not interested whatsoever in utilizing the carbon dioxide that was sequestered in the salt water because, well, he just didn't have enough gray matter, and I couldn't get his interest. So that's where it died. Oh, well. So it would have worked, I promise you. We could have used it and had a no net CO2 fuel out of it as well. Plus, we probably could have ended world starvation. But, you know, you can't do too many great things, I suppose. So Mr. Schellenberger says we should have increasingly stringent regulations on coal to help us move away from it. Oh, yes, I could tell you right now, if you want to take a little trip, you drive down Interstate 81 or down 77 through Virginia, and you will see the coal miner signs on the side of the road, the big billboard to say, "Welcome to Obama's no work zone." Yeah, he's put an entire industry out of work. Through federal research and public funding, he says, shale gas is today's golden boy. Wind, solar, and nuclear hold the same potential. It's true. Solar has, I think, turned the corner. It is now the remaining solar plants do have good technology, not like Solyndra, which was way outdated technology. Beautiful robots, nice building. It was one of the best dog and pony shows I ever saw. It was just nice. They did a really, really good job. Should have been the solar power show. It's just sexy stuff. But their technology was old and not very efficient. We're up to 19% now, 19% efficient with the solar panels. And some of the panels with some extra coatings that are electroactive in other wavelengths of light, we've actually got up to 31% efficiency out of the solar panels. And no glass. Yes, we're using Teflon laminations now, very lightweight. Not bulletproof, but you could shoot a bullet through it, and it will only lose the ability to produce electricity where the hole is. The rest of the polycrystalline does just fine at putting out electricity and pretty lightweight. We used to have a measurement of, watts per kilogram, but we don't do that anymore because now the solar panels are so lightweight that it's a moot point. In other words, you don't have to carry around all that weight and justify having it, and you don't have to have a really, strong roof structure now to hold the 80-pound solar panel that has a, tempered 5/16-inch sheet of glass on it. We're past all that now. We don't use any of that stuff. This is all non-glare, lightweight stuff, and the price is coming down. Yeah, still all the chips are made in China. The chip is actually the polycrystalline layer. But the soldering processes and lamination processes are mostly being done in the States now, and they're pretty nice. There is some what we call thin layer or sprayed solar technology, but it's not very efficient. Only about 2 to 5%. Not very efficient at all. It takes acres and acres and acres of stuff to make any power. So I would say that if you want to invest in anywhere from a 2 to 5 megawatt solar power station, it's a good investment. You got 20 years before the solar panels start losing appreciable efficiency. You'd probably be around 50% efficient at the end of 20 years if you take care of them. That is to say, keep them clean and, you know, don't let them get beat up too bad. Then they'll put out a lot of power. And you could manage the input of it. You could build a couple of acres, and then 2 years later, a couple more acres, 2 years later, a couple more acres, and then at the end of 20 years, you'll be back on the cycle of replacing 2 acres at a time, and the price will be way cheaper then, and we'll have recycling programs. So it'll be an excellent investment for you. Wind, the same thing, although the weakness in wind technology is actually the gearbox. Because the gearboxes are direct drive and the wind is quite variable, somewhere between 20 miles per hour, although we don't see 20 miles per hour too much. 15 miles an hour is about the maximum speed for a wind generator. And what happens is that the gearbox ends up heating up because it's all direct drive and there's no variable speeds in it or anything. And it's more a study of tribology. Tribology is the lubrication that's used in the gearboxes. And there's been some inroads in that, some Teflons and some different kind of shell products that are blended under pressure that get good wear out of the gears. But the real secret, the real breakthrough is in variable speed drives. Variable speed drives for the wind generators. And they're coming. They're coming. They've been designed, they've been patented, they're about 2 years away from really getting out there for a system that can turn a 2 or 4 megawatt generator. That means that when the wind's 3 miles an hour, you can still generate some power because you're not fighting that really tall bull gear in the gearbox. Got it? Okay. Anyway, just trying to keep you up to date with some of the technology that's out there. Wind generators are, you know, definitely a good way to go. If you've ever flown into Amsterdam, just look out the window before you land, and you'll see tons of wind generators out there at sea. Nobody sees them unless you're flying in. They're way out past the seabirds. They do great. They're awesome. It's all free energy. Meanwhile, some companies are unilaterally acting. Calvert Instruments discusses, Google, AT&T, Coca-Cola, blah, blah, blah. Google, for instance, publicly lists its renewable energy holdings as well as its carbon footprint that it wants to reduce to zero. I commend them for doing that, although I condemn them for other things that they do. Meanwhile, AT&T also has a goal of increasing its green energy and decreasing its greenhouse gas emissions by 20% by 2020. Coke has pledged 5% cuts in all of its emissions by 2015. And many companies like Vision Motor Cars, visionmotorcars.com, if you want to check out electric vehicles, has a program where municipalities can cut their emissions to zero just by switching their gasoline-powered truck fleets over to our Everest pickup truck. So check it out. If you're in a municipality or know someone in a municipality, give them a call. Tell them to check out the website. The leasing programs are awesome. Randy Evans, a co-author of a book called Climate Change and Insurance, says that the global environment is not at a tipping point, but he told his reporter that conditions are at a median point whereby all political and business leaders must manage the apparent risks. And I stress the word apparent because they're not real. If you can afford it, if there's a profit in your business, just keep on doing what you're doing. Eventually, you're going to run out of fuel anyway, and you're going to have to make the change. If you think about it, folks, it's a little primeval, okay? You're shoveling your planet into the tank, and you're burning it. That's a little primeval. And I think Well, we're all just a little bit more mature than that, aren't we? Can't we just all be electric for a while? You know, and electricity is not the only form of energy out there. I mean, it's a form of energy we understand. We've been using it since the mid-1800s. We don't really know what it is, but we know how to use it. I know that. What I'm saying is you could plug into the wall. We know how to generate it by, you know, rubbing two sticks together to make fire. I'm kidding. Rubbing a magnet past a wire, you will induce a current flow in the wire. It's called the electromagnetic effect. You remember, come on, Einstein's, yeah, patent, got it. Yeah, you remember all that now. But, you know, we're fighting the Faraday effect, which is the amount of force that it takes to push the magnet past the wire or the wire past the magnet, either one. There is an opposing force which is greater than the work that you actually get out of the electricity, so there's no free lunch there. But we really don't understand what electricity is. We don't know where the electrons come from, and we don't know where they go when we're done with them. Mysteriously, we create them or we coax them into our dimension from another dimension. Who cares? It works. It runs our laptops and our TVs and our smartphones and our blow dryers, and that's all we care, right? But there are other forms of energy out there. It's what I'm saying. And some of us are on the verge of figuring out how to coax those forms of energy into our dimension where we can use it. Okay? It might not be electricity. We might be able to convert it into electricity. But honestly, it might not be electricity. We might have to transform that kind of work into a form that we can use, like, you know, turn a generator where it will make electricity in this dimension. But I'm telling you, there's other forms of energy out there, okay? And we're about ready to tap into it. If you want to listen to Joe Joseph's program tomorrow night, we're going to talk again about the fusion-driven rocket. We'll provide a little bit more detail on that. Anyway, man-made emissions are only one cause of global warming. The rest of it is pretty natural. You know, we have natural methane emissions. We have volcanoes. And we have solar radiation and galactic radiation, and all of these ultimately are a much greater cause of global warming. But at the end of the day, we're not talking about 90% increases in the heating of the Earth or in the capturing or bouncing back of the heat of the Earth back to the Earth. We're only talking about 1% or 1.5% or maybe 2%. You know, it's just that last little bit that takes the planet into a place of what we call thermal runaway, you know, seas boiling end of the earth kind of stuff, where we're talking about a third of the seas dying and all the trees, etc. That tipping point, you know what I'm saying? You can't do chronic pollution to the planet and expect it not to have an effect. Acute effects, like one spill or one forest fire or one volcanic explosion or a couple of nuclear bombs, yeah. But because the planet can rebound from that. You know, it's big. It's got a lot of volume. It's going through space at 18.5 miles per second. A lot of stuff can happen. But chronic effects, what you do over centuries has an effect on the planet. The planet cannot counteract all of that. It can do it for a short amount of time, but then it's going to get to a point of no return when you've just put too much out and you can't get it back. Dealing with global warming will be expensive, but only because we've already done it this way for so long. You know what I'm saying? You work for places that do that all the time, don't you? You might have a great idea and they say, yeah, look, dude, that's a really great idea, but we've always done it this way. And you say to them, but look, all I'm trying to say is I don't care if you've done it this way. This is a better way. And they say, well, yeah, but, you know, we already have all this investment. We already have these lines on the floor, and we have our lighting, and we have our way, you know. It's the way we do it. But it's stupid. It's what I'm saying. Planet Earth can be dumb. I mean, the way we do it here in the United States is not the way other countries do it. Most other countries don't do it this way. They do it a different way. Why? Because they just developed a different way of doing it, and some of it is better, way better than the way we're doing it. But most of it is worse, way worse than we're doing it. I mean, they just burn stuff just to burn it, or they dump stuff over the hill and let it go into the river, or if they just dump it right in the river. We don't do that anymore. We used to, but we don't do that anymore. We got to teach the rest of the world what we know, and then we got to be smart enough. We got to be humble enough to learn from the earth and say, okay, I know we've been doing it this way all along. I know we've been slamming neutrons into uranium until it gets, you know, so unstable that the only way to keep it from melting down is to keep it in the proximity of lead to grab all the neutrons as they come off so it doesn't go into criticality. But we use it to boil water. We use the water, the steam, to turn turbines to make electricity because we love electricity. But it's stupid. There are better ways of doing it. Better ways. Okay? The proposition posted by this author, Evans, is that the price tag will be more affordable if it's paid up front. That sentiment is shared by the Breakthrough Institute Schellenberger, not necessarily shared by me, because doing it the right way is always the cheapest way to do it. And if you have to change, it's only because some giant, huge organization is making a fortune off the way we do it now. I'm saying, you could toss the meters out the window, and yeah, J.P. Morgan won't be making money anymore, but there'll be another company that is. So it's no big deal. Now, I'm done talking about climate change because I get all worked up over it, and because I kind of have a foot in both camps, you know. I want things to be clean, but I also want to be able to drive 80 miles an hour. And I think we can have both. And I think you do too. If you agree with me, just give me a call, 888-429-5471, or anywhere else on planet or off planet, 530-413-9537. Or if you're listening to this as an archive, write me at bagnew@x2-radio.com and just let me know your thoughts. All right. Now, I want to talk about something that's just recently happened. I'm going to try to stay away from the politics of it, but I want to talk about the science of it. I want to talk about what this does to the algorithm of peace. An algorithm is a complex mathematical formula, but it isn't really that complex. It's just a formula that takes in multiple inputs. And each input into this has an effect on the formula, on the outcome of the formula, but at different rates. So it's not like 2 plus 2 equals 4. It's more like X plus Y equals Z. Okay? And each one of those is a formula. X is a formula, Y is a formula, and Z is the result. And each one of those formulas acts like a mathematical engine. You throw inputs into it, and you get an output, and that's an algorithm. So recently, Israel has attacked Syria. I told you it was coming. I mean, if you've been listening to the program, you already knew this was going to happen. Okay? I mean, we draw red lines in the sand all the time. You can play hopscotch with them down the sidewalk. We don't do much about red lines in this country. But Israel, when they draw a red line on the sidewalk or on the sand, you know, by gosh, it's a red line. If you step over it, there's going to be consequences. Well, a series of powerful explosions rocked the outskirts of Damascus this morning, which Syrian state television said is a result of Israeli missile attacks on Syrian military installation. And that much is true. Yes, Israel did attack. They were Syrian military installations. One was a weapons production plant. It's on a mountainside. And the reason that they did it was not because that was going on, but because the missiles and advanced weapons were about to be transferred to Hezbollah. Twice in 4 months, Israel has sought to disrupt the pipeline of weapons to Hezbollah. You know who Hezbollah is? They're troublemakers. They sit over there in Palestine, and they lob rockets over the fence into neighborhoods and you know, city streets and stuff in Tel Aviv, and they don't really have a lot of guidance on it. They're not designed to conquer the country. They're just designed to terrorize them and poke them. Well, you know, most of the rockets, they just kind of shove them down into a hole in the ground. Literally, I mean, their launch pad is just a hole in the ground. So, and they pretty much, you know, light it like you would a bottle rocket and then stand back and watch it go over the wall. And they'll lob a couple hundred of these things. And they're not really big, 60, 70 pounds, 80 pounds, and they'll get up over there. Sometimes they'll get off and land in a vacant lot, but sometimes they land in a nursery and they kill people. And, of course, the Israeli people, they don't run and hide. If they have a bomb go off in a restaurant, the neighbors will come out and they'll sweep it up and they'll set the tables back up and they'll have a party in that restaurant that night. They do it. They do it, I promise. And then they'll dance and they'll drink and they'll sing and they'll throw the ashes away. And if they're dead, they'll mourn them. If they blow up a bus, the next day the buses are twice as full. Why? Because the Israeli people will not be terrorized. They will not have their lifestyles changed because that's what this is. Anyway, these weapons really need to stay simple. And the Israelis kind of put up with that. But as more advanced weapons get into the hand of Hezbollah, they can do serious, more serious damage. And so Syria was in a position and was making moves to move these weapons into the hands of Hezbollah. And so Israel said, that's a red line. You crossed it. That's it. The strike was aimed at disrupting the arms pipeline that runs from Syria to Hezbollah, the militant Lebanese organization. And it highlighted the mounting stakes for Hezbollah and Israel as Syria becomes more chaotic. Now, keep in mind that there's a lot going on in Syria, and you are definitely not getting the straight story. Iran and Hezbollah have both backed President Bashar al-Assad, who's the guy you saw in the news this morning. He rarely gets out, but this morning he did get out in the public near the university and made a little speech. There is a civil war going on there, but it's not very civil, nothing civil about it. Fighting in Syria is escalating. They also have a powerful interest in expediting the delivery of advanced weapons to Hezbollah in case Mr. Assad loses his grip on power and Syria ceases to be an effective channel for funneling weapons from Iran. The missiles that were the target of the Israeli raid had been shipped from Iran and were being stored in a warehouse at Damascus International Airport when they were struck, according to an American official. So these missiles weren't even made in Syria. They were just trucked through Syria to this airport, and they were Iranian missiles, more advanced missiles. Now, Iran has sought to use the threat of a Hezbollah missile attack against Israeli territory as a means of building up its ally and deterring Israel from conducting airstrikes on Iranian nuclear installations that Israeli and American officials believe are part of an Iranian nuclear weapons program. And I really stress the word believe, because the only people that really know are the Iranians. Oh, okay, and maybe the Israelis, because they definitely have agents in the area and they know what's going on. But the Iranians have built their most secret places, their most strategic places, not out in the desert away from everybody. Oh, no, 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 no. They put it right underneath the kindergarten and deep in the ground. So you really have to get a weapon to bore down through that third grade classroom and get underneath there and blow the whole thing up. And, of course, Americans don't like doing that. Israelis don't either. And so it becomes a real problem to let the program keep going. Some analysts believe that a strong Hezbollah would also emerge as a powerful ally for Mr. Assad, which no doubt it would, because they are of the same tribe. The relationship between Hezbollah and the Assad regime is stronger now, said Talal Atrisi, a professor at Lebanese University in Beirut, who has good relations with Hezbollah. If Mr. Assad falls, Hezbollah knows the axis of Syria, Hezbollah and Iran will be greatly weakened, he said. And it's true. And that's the key position that Syria plays. Anciently, Syria was the tribal leader of that area, the nobility of the area. And the government of Syria is of the same tribal alignment as the government of Iran. However, the people of Syria, the people who are ruled by the government, not governed by the government in Syria, have quite a different religious sect. It's the difference between the Sunni and the Shia. They just have different ways of saying, you know, Allah is God and Muhammad was his prophet. And they're willing to fight to the death about it, and they often do. So what has happened is outsiders, lots of outsiders, bringing gifts, have come into the suburbs of Syria and are stirring things up. And unfortunately, as usual, I strongly believe, and I'm not going to back down from this because I'm pretty sure that I'm correct, America's one of those troublemakers bearing gifts. So we are training rebels in Jordan, which is a neighboring country, and we are arming them with all kinds of technology, laser sighting, communication, satellite technology, surveillance technology, and possibly weapons, although I would say the weapons have to be very, very strategically placed and very carefully placed, because if it's found out that we're supplying weapons to the Syrian rebels, it will not go well for us anywhere. So but I can just tell you that the training is being done. As the Obama administration considers how to dissuade Mr. Assad from ordering a chemical weapons attack, the use of such weapons, the White House has said, would cross a red line. You know, the red lines I'm talking about are the ones that make the hopscotch thing that everybody's been hopping over for the last 4 years because, well, okay, Obama bluffs a lot. If you're going to play cards with him, you could kick his ass because he just bluffs all the time. Israel, by striking the warehouse, is clearly showing that it is prepared to stand behind the red lines that Israel sets. The Israelis are saying, okay, whichever way the civil war is going, we're going to keep our red lines, which are different from Obama's, said Ehud Yari, an Israel-based fellow of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. On Friday, Sana, the official Syrian news agency, reported an attack on the Damascus airport by Syrian rebels firing rockets at an aircraft and fuel dump, an account that American officials say may have been intended to obscure the fact that the target was a warehouse full of missiles. Kaboom. An American official who asked not to be identified because he was, well, afraid of being killed, he was discussing intelligence reports, said the targeted shipment consisted of Iranian-made Fateh 110s, a mobile, accurate, solid-fueled missile that has the range to strike Tel Aviv and much of Israel from southern Lebanon, and that represents a considerable improvement over liquid-fueled Scud missile, which they've been using since the early 90s. Two prominent Israeli defense analysts said the shipment included Scud-Ds, a missile that Syrians have developed from Russian weapons with a range of up to 422 miles, and that's long enough to reach Eilat in southernmost Israel. Israel's about 140 kilometers long. From Lebanon, Syrian forces loyal to Mr. Assad have used Fateh 110 missiles against the Syrian opposition. Some American officials are unsure whether the new shipment was intended for use by Hezbollah or by the Assad government, but nobody was taking any chances. One American official said the warehouse that was struck in the Israeli attack overnight Thursday was believed to be under the control of operatives from Hezbollah and Iran's paramilitary Quds force. Hezbollah is now believed to have more missiles and fighters than it had before the 2006 battle with Israel, when Hezbollah missiles forced a third of Israel's population into shelters, and they also hit as far as Haifa. That's a long way. That's right on the outskirts of Tel Aviv. A Pentagon official said in 2010 that Hezbollah's arsenal was believed to include a small number of Fateh 110s, and additional shipments would add to Hezbollah's striking power. You know, Israel's only going to take so much, and then they're going to hit back. And they did not fly over Syrian airspace until they got right to the airport. They used a neighboring country and got permission. They didn't invade anybody's airspace until they got right over position. So, red lines in the sand. They're, you know, sort of like the cartoon where you say, don't step over this line, and they step over. Don't step over this line, and they step over. Well, that's pretty much what we do, because after all, as far as this administration is concerned, there's no such thing as Islamic terrorists. All right, let's talk about something different. We are getting ready to enter, as I said in the very beginning of the program tonight, Halley's Comet. A meteor shower is created by bits of Halley's Comet, which is now at its peak. It's about 9:47 Eastern time right now. If you go out at about 6 hours, just after midnight, if you can get past the cloud cover, you should be able to see about 50 to 60 per hour. It's a possibility they could be less, but they might be really worth watching. Not little tiny, you know, granule-sized meteors. Some of these will actually become meteorites. And I'm not saying they'll fall in your backyard, but some of these come in as nice fireballs, and they split and turn green and blue, and it's just kind of nice. So if you've got some Boy Scouts, you might want to, you know, gear them up and take them out there. It's going to be kind of chilly anywhere you go in the United States. Also, on the cutting edge of technology, the rocket-powered supersonic flight of Virgin Galactic Spaceship 2 took off this Monday, marked a big milestone for the company. I'm telling you, bonuses all around. The history-making Spaceship 2 test flight on Monday really marks their entrance into the final phase of vehicle evaluation prior to commercial suborbital surface from Spaceport America in New Mexico. It is really a stupendous day, said Richard Branson, who witnessed the flight from California's Mojave Air and Spaceport. Big grins all over our faces after many years of hard work. So I believe they have, yeah, they have the flights booked up for several months as $200,000 a seat and lots of deposits on hand. So that's all coming together. All right, let's one of the subjects that's near and dear to my heart here. Hold on while I take a sip of my grapefruit juice. The question of this section is, how stupid are we? I'm going to play a piece by Michio Kaku, because he really made an excellent point a little while back where he was talking about education and where we are with stuff. You know, Congress declares that the national education goals are the following. And this is from a system that was called Goals 2000. Now, it's gone through a couple of iterations. It was called Education Edge for a while, and they tried to implement it in Tennessee, and then they tried to implement it in a couple of the states, and it didn't fly too well because it was outcome-based. They claim that by the year 2000, we're in the year 2013, okay, so we have a good way to grade this now. All children in America will start school ready to learn. It's a little difficult to quantify, but that's sort of preschool. The objectives for the goal are that all children will have access to high quality and developmentally appropriate preschool programs. I think most parents access at least 6 months to a year of preschool before their kid starts school. Even in underprivileged neighborhoods, 3-year-olds are given free access to a preschool. And most moms are really happy to get those kids out of the house for half a day. It integrates them with other kids. They begin to get ready for the school experience. It's not so, traumatizing when they start kindergarten. They also receive nutrition, physical activity experiences, health care as they arrive to school. They find out about low birth weight babies and all of this, and it's a good program. And school completion by the year 2000, high school graduation rate will increase to at least 90%. The nation must dramatically reduce its school dropout rate, and 75% of the students who drop out will successfully complete a high school degree or its equivalent. Now, what does that mean? 90% of the students will receive a diploma. Does that mean that the students are smarter and thus they're graduating, they're actually meeting all the requirements to getting that diploma? Or does it mean that the bar is simply lowered so that the students who would have dropped out can get the diploma anyway? Well, that's a really good question. In fact, that's the $64 million question. By the year 2000, United States students will be first in the world in mathematics and science achievement. I think we're pretty close to last for all developed countries. The objectives for this goal are that mathematics and science education, including the metric system of measurement, will be strengthened throughout the system, especially in the early grades. I still don't know a elementary school or middle school teacher that can negotiate the metric system. The number of teachers with a substantive background in mathematics and science, including in the metric system of measurement, will increase by 50%. That has absolutely not happened. In fact, I think it has decreased by 50% because the teachers with a substantive background in mathematics and science no longer work for the school system. They can't afford to. The number of United States undergraduate and graduate students, especially women and minorities who complete degrees in mathematics, science, and engineering, will increase significantly. And that is where I want to bring in Michio Kaku's point. Let's find out why it is minorities who are completing the degrees in mathematics, science, and engineering. Go ahead and play the clip.
I must disagree with my esteemed colleague here. Okay. Let me say that science is the engine of prosperity. From steam power to electricity to the laser to the transistor to the computer.
That's not true.
We're
That's
talking
technology.
About. Hey,
it's
hey, can I have my? Can I have my
sure.
You had your say. Let
yes.
me have my say.
Yes.
However, the information revolution has a weakness, and the weakness is precisely the educational system. The United States has the worst educational system known to science. Our graduates compete regularly at the level of third world countries. So how come the scientific establishment of the United States doesn't collapse? If we're producing a generation of dummies, if the stupid index of America keeps rising every year, just watch network television and reality shows, right? How come the scientific establishment of the United States doesn't collapse? Let me tell you something. Some of you may not know this. America has a secret weapon. That secret weapon is the H-1B. Without the H-1B, the scientific establishment of this country would collapse. Forget about Google. Forget about Silicon Valley. There would be no Silicon Valley without the H-1B. And you know what the H-1B is? It's the genius visa, okay? You realize that in the United States, 50% of all PhD candidates are foreign-born. At my system, one of the biggest in the United States, 100% of the PhD candidates are foreign-born. The United States is a magnet sucking up all the brains of the world, but now the brains are going back.
Right.
They're going back to China. They're going back to India. And people are saying, oh my God, there's a Silicon Valley in India now. Oh my God, there's a Silicon Valley in China. Duh. Where did it come from? It came from the United States. So don't tell me that science isn't the engine of prosperity. You remove the H-1B visa and you collapse the economy. In Wall Street Journal, editorialized against a congressman who wanted to ban the H-1B, saying they'll take jobs away from the American people. The Wall Street Journal said, look, there are no Americans who can take these jobs. These are at the highest level of high technology. They don't take away jobs for Americans. They create entire industries. And so that's why we have an Achilles heel, and that's the educational system. Sociology majors are not necessarily going to be the ones determining the future of Silicon Valley. But physicists, engineers, we need more of them, not less.
The irony is... The irony is, I agree with the immigration issues, what you're saying, and I'm at a school, of course, and Peter's a graduate of a school where indeed immigration.
Your school wouldn't exist without the H-1B.
Of course, but I'm not.
You've got to get back to the future of business.
But hold on a second. No. I'm not arguing against an H-1B. I completely agree with this issue, and the point on the future of business that he's making, which is very, very important, is the nature of human capital. What is misunderstood here is, again, how poorly run schools are. MIT is a notable exception in this regard. His school is not. Because what happens is they run in these introductory science and engineering classes at Illinois and Wisconsin and Michigan. They run freshman and sophomore years as flunk out operations. They run it as a boot camp, and then people are surprised that people don't take science, that they don't take the STEM courses. The point that I'm trying to make, which I think is an important one in this regard, is that the way educational systems are set up right now is that we have distorted incentives that undermine the ability for America to have a homegrown science and technology.
So the point that I'm trying to make here is that for the first time in decades, the United States is making steady gains in the number of high school students earning diplomas and the number of college students earning diplomas, but they're not Americans. When I got my degree in nuclear chemistry from Tennessee Technological University, I was one of about a half a dozen Caucasians. That's it, half a dozen in my graduating class. The rest were from India and China. Why is that? Well, I reject the claim that there are no Americans smart enough to take these classes. I think there are Americans smart enough to take the classes. But most Americans have been in an educational system that isn't teaching them how to learn. It's teaching them how to work with others. It's teaching them how to get a job. It's barely teaching them how to balance a checkbook, but it's teaching them how to obey laws and how to fit into a team and, you know, how to work in a factory and, you know, maybe college isn't for you kind of stuff. And these flunk out programs that he's talking about, what they're talking about is when a science freshman comes into a university and he's exposed to his first class in calculus or his first class in biology, he realizes that even though he had biology in high school, he doesn't know anything. High school has not prepared him for college because it didn't cram the knowledge down his head. He thought he could go to school for 6 hours a day, not do any homework, be absent for a quarter of the classes, get his diploma, which the school's going to give him, and that he'd be ready for college. And that just simply isn't the case. And there are a number of states, and it is growing every year, it just grew by South Carolina, that are passing laws in their states that high school students don't even have to pass an exit exam to get their diploma. And in other words, you can go to school K through 12 and be functionally illiterate, and you're still going to get a diploma. Oh, we'll hit that 90%. We'll hit that 90% graduation rate, and we'll have a big-ass party. But you're not going to know anything. You're not going to know how to do anything. And if you don't know how to do stuff, you don't know how to think, then you're not going to be inspired when you're exposed to new knowledge. You're not going to rise to new challenges. What you're going to do is you're going to go to work in the factory, in the industry that was started by a graduate from India. You're going to go to work in a field that never even existed before the guy in China took the classes and was able to come up with that idea. In other words, America's leadership as an innovator is probably over. Oh, we've got some smart kids out there. Come on, don't get me wrong. But of that 90% of the kids that are graduating, I would venture to say, and I'm pretty confident about this, we have less, not more, less numbers of qualified students that can go on to college and excel. You know, I have seen a lot of people come through the PhD programs at the universities, and they couldn't think their way out of a wet paper bag. Oh, they might know their field of expertise fairly well, and I use a small F with fairly. But are they masters of the philosophy? I doubt it seriously. I meet them all the time. I meet geologists, I meet chemists, I meet chemical engineers, I meet mechanical engineers, electrical engineers. I meet them every day in plants that I audit. When I show them how to run their plants more efficiently, and I show them mathematical tools for analyzing the way their production works. Do I know everything? No. But I'm probably one of the top half dozen master black belts in the country. But then again, you know, I'm in my mid-50s. I'm of that other generation. I'm talking about the new generation. The building of a grad nation, which was a paper written by Robert Balfonds, a leading scholar of dropout rates at Johns Hopkins University, found strong improvements in graduation rates in a diverse collection of states, including Tennessee, Louisiana, Alaska, California, Texas, and New York. The national graduation rate jumped from 71.7% in 2001 to 78.2% in 2010, with the pace of improvement accelerating in the past few years. But folks, you can graduate anybody if you keep lowering the bar. And you can't go to a national test, because if you go to a national test, then you got to have national textbooks. And if you got to have national textbooks, well, then the diversity in education is gone. And all you have is the approved state education. So we have an issue in our educational system. I'm going to cover it a little bit more in the next hour. Let's go ahead and take a break. We'll get into our final hour, and I am going to have to ask you to put your seatbelts on. It's going to be a wild ride. Be prepared. Be prepared. Be right back after this.
Well, I dreamed I saw the knights in armor come, saying something about a queen. There were peasants singing and drummers drumming, and the archers split the tree. There was a fanfare blowing to the sun that was floating on the breeze. Looking Mother Nature on the run in the 21st century. Well, I was lying in a burned up basement with the full moon in my eyes. I was hoping for a replacement when the sun burst through the sky. There was a band playing in my head, and I felt like getting high. I was thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Thinking about what a friend had said, I was hoping it was a lie. Well,
spaceship flying in the yellow haze of the sun. There were children crying and colors flying all around the chosen one.
All in a dream, all in a dream, the loading had begun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun.
Welcome back to X Squared Radio, third and final hour, May 5th, 2013. You know, we cover a lot of subjects here, and just because I find them interesting doesn't mean you find them interesting, but obviously you tune in week after week for more than 8 years now, and I appreciate it. I can't tell you how much I appreciate it. Every once in a while, I do get a phone call on this program, but most people just kind of listen, sit back and listen because they just like it. But if you want to call, our phone number is 888-429-5471 anywhere in North America. Anywhere else on planet or off planet, the number is 530-413-9537. Just some final thoughts about the education system. You know, Thomas Jefferson was a passionate teacher and realized that one of the keys to holding on to the sovereignty of a nation, that is to say, not allowing tyranny to take it over, was by letting the education system remain in the hands of locals, local school boards, locally elected school boards that were, beholden to the taxpayers of that particular county. And that's the way it is in our country. Now, we have had national, federal standards try to impose a single standard over the United States for a long, long time. It's been tried numerous times, and it's always failed because the states realize that this is their territory. And you'll recall that the Democrats believe that when the nation was young, we had a few states, somewhere between 13 and 50, you'll recall. And those states, although individually were fairly strong, the federal government was very weak. And so we needed strong states, we needed state militias, we needed a good investment in diversity. From state to state, some states grew sorghum and some states, you know, built wagon wheels and some states did the banking and others were into shipbuilding. And that diversity coming together, almost specializing state by state because of the natural resources that were available in each state, made us a strong nation. It allowed us to trade with one another. And the federal government was just there to manage the interstate commerce. It was there to give us a common currency, to give us, you know, licensing abilities that would retain their integrity over state lines. And we still have that. You can drive on the same driver's license from New York to California, and it doesn't matter where you go. You can buy liquor and you can get a speeding ticket just fine with your driver's license anywhere. And that's what the federal government is for. When it came to education, however, each state had its own standards. And so the textbook writers, whether they're writing books in geography and civil history, or whether they're writing math books, or whether they're writing psychology books or English literature books, the school boards from each state and literally from each county will go to the textbook trade shows or the textbooks catalogs, and they'll select the textbooks based upon the curricula that's important to that state. Most states have a state standard exam that you take periodically, third grade, sixth grade. I think fourth grade is one of the grades, actually, and then eighth grade, and then finally high school. And passing those exams gives the state its scorecard for how that state's county schools are doing relative to, you know, teaching their students what they're supposed to know. Now, obviously, the schools themselves are graded on how the students do on that test because it's a measure of how good the teacher is by how the student does on the test. That makes sense to you, doesn't it? That's kind of their grade card. And, of course, part of the money that they get from the state, whether it's grants or even federal disbursements, are usually gauged upon how they do on that test, and it is not inversely proportional. In other words, if you have a lousy school and everybody in your school is failing, you don't get more money. It's not like the football draft. You don't get more money than the school that's doing very well. It's the other way around. The schools that excel get more money. That means they get better books, better desks, better computers, better buildings, etc. And so there is a motivation to do well on the state exam, which means they teach the test. They figure out year after year what's on the tests, and they rotate the tests, and they don't change it too radically subject to subject, whether it's reading comprehension or mathematics. And so the teachers teach the test. They prepare their students to take that test. And when the students take the test, the teachers go home and sweat spinal fluid and wait for the grades to come back. If it's good, then they get a promotion and they get to keep their job and they get tenure and all kinds of wonderful benefits. If they do poorly, it's not good for anybody. Superintendents lose their jobs and et cetera. It's just a mess. Now, that's what happens on a state level. So there are 50 states competing and all kinds of counties in those different states. And so the textbook makers try to do their best at being fair with all the information so that they can stay in business. Whether it's Rand McNally or, you know, Skoog and Leary or whoever it is that's making the textbook, then they compete against one another. And that's the way it is. That's the way it's always been. I'm not saying it's the best way to do it, but it is the way that Jefferson set it up, and it seems to be working okay. When you get a federal exam, it's a little bit different. Now you don't have the diversity from state to state. You just have one test that they use in every single state, every single school, which means they're going to teach the test. And teaching the test means that they're going to get the federally approved textbook. The textbook by which students do the best on that test. Now what you've done is you've lost your diversity, which means that the federal government can say, this is the answer to this question. Why did President Lincoln fight the Civil War? Well, that's a pretty deep question that could spawn all kinds of essay questions, could it not? But the official federal answer is, to free the slaves. Answer B. Is it true? Well, some states would say, yeah, it's true, but others might not. And so you lose your diversity. You are taught the federal lesson, and you give the federal answers. And that leads to tyranny. Now, relative to state tests, a bill came up for a vote. It actually comes up for a vote next week in South Carolina, that would eliminate the requirement that high school students pass the exit exam in order to graduate. I guess they want to get up over that 78% mark. Now students take the HASP, or the HSAP, the High School Assessment Program Test. Starting in the 10th grade, they have to pass it before the end of their senior year to graduate. They have 2 years. They can take it as many times as they want. According to the State Department of Education, 80.1% of students passed the exam on their first try last year. That's not bad. I have taken exams where 67% of the students fail it the first time. Yes. Well, it's true. It's called the Certified Quality Engineer Exam, the CQE. Yeah, go try and take it. Yes, I did pass it my first time. Stacy Craig, a sophomore at Dreher High School in Columbia, South Carolina, took the exam last week. She says it's very simple, and it's not anything really hard. Everyone should be able to pass. And if you can't pass, well, then you need to stay in school. But Representative Phil Owens, a Republican from Easley, chairman of the House Education and Public Works Committee, is the main sponsor of the bill. He says 4 years of high school shouldn't boil down to how someone does on one test. They meet all the requirements, earn the Carnegie units, and then all of a sudden they have to take one test that can determine whether or not they receive a diploma. He says that test is not recognized as necessary to further their education, whether it be in the tech school route or the four-year institution route or whatever. But even though future students would not have to pass the test to graduate, they would still have to take the test. J.W. Ragley, spokesman for the State Department of Education, explains. He says, "We're required by both federal and state law to assess the progress of schools and school districts and high schools, and so we have to have an assessment." The department is planning to start using a new computer-based test in the 2014-15 school year. The current HSAP costs taxpayers more than $3.6 million to print, administer, and score. Ragley says the new test will save at least $400,000 a year. Nice move, Mr. Ragley. He says of the current exam, unfortunately, it doesn't have a lot of relevance anymore outside of high school. No employer and no college asks, "What was your score on the high school exit exam when you apply for college or apply for a job?" Well, I beg to differ, Mr. Ragley. We ask as a company, and there is an exam when you graduate college as well. By the way, it's called the College Graduation Exam. I scored in the top 0.1%. And they do ask. According to the National Conference of State Legislatures, 25 states require high school students to pass an exit exam to graduate. For crying out loud, folks, you got 2 years to pass it. You can take it in the 10th grade, the 11th grade, and the 12th grade. And if you can't pass that exam, you don't deserve a diploma, period. By the way, that's down from 28 in 2010. Georgia, North Carolina, and Tennessee dropped the requirement. Alabama will end its exit exam in 2015. Just too darn expensive, isn't it? While the number of states that have implemented high school exit exams continues to increase, so has the difficulty of the tests. In 2002, only six states based their exit exams on the 10th grade standards or higher. By 2006, the number had increased to 18. But passing the high school exam doesn't necessarily mean that a student is prepared for college, as most high school exit exams only test skills students should master by the completion of the 10th grade. Yes, but I can tell you that if you can't pass that 10th grade exam, you're darn sure not ready for college. I know when I was teaching freshman chemistry and freshman algebra, I had students in my class that had never seen a fraction before, or they could never solve a fraction before. Oh, by the time they got out of my class, they could do it just fine because I had to do a little retro teaching there for those students. But that's deplorable to see a freshman in college that does not know what a fraction is unbelievable. Unbelievable. So I think all 50 states need to get back to where they're doing some kind of testing. And they should know how their classes are doing. Now, if you let a central authority rule the education of the people, then you have a single school system. The approved message reaches the classroom. Students will only be taught what they need to pass the state exam. And I'm using state as federal. Nothing more, nothing less. Within one generation, the effectiveness of education will be outcome-based. That you can take to the bank. That means that we would gauge the effectiveness of education based on your ability to get a job with that education. Education would be very quickly adapted to prepare you to work, not to learn. Your ability to think and work in teams rather than as innovative individuals would be molded into the curricula. Dr. Kaku's claim that whole industries are being created from the mind of only a few brilliant people is already happening. But would there be room for geniuses in a nationally managed classroom? I think not. All right. Go ahead and raise your chair up and put your tray back in its locked position. And you may want to put your seatbelt on. This segment is called the Benghazi Shuffle. We may never know what went on in Benghazi. 2 weeks ago, we talked about Rear Admiral Charles Gouet, who was reportedly fired by President Obama for disobeying stand-down orders and launching forces during the September 11, 2012 terrorist attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, Libya. U.S. News reports on Obama's unprecedented firing of a powerful U.S. Navy commander during wartime, Admiral Gouet. His removal for allegations of inappropriate leadership judgment that arose during the strike group's deployment to the Middle East. The GRU report, however, states that Admiral Gouet's firing by President Obama was due to this strike force commander disobeying orders when he ordered his forces on 11 September to assist and provide intelligence for American military forces ordered into action by U.S. Army General Carter Ham, who was then the commander of the United States Africa Command, AFRICOM, against terrorist forces attacking the American consulate in Benghazi, Libya. General Ham had been in command of the initial 2011 U.S.-NATO military intervention in Libya, who, like General or Admiral Gouet, was fired by Obama, both at the same time. And as we can in part read from the U.S. military insider accounts of this growing internal conflict between the White House and U.S. military leaders, listen closely. Quote, "The information I heard was that General Carter Ham, as head of AFRICOM, received the same emails the White House received requesting help support as the attack was taking place. Help. General Ham immediately had a rapid response unit ready and communicated to the Pentagon that he had a unit ready. General Ham then received the order to stand down. His response was to screw it. He was going to help anyhow. Within 30 seconds to a minute after making the move to respond, his second in command apprehended General Ham and told him he was now relieved of his command." Now, my question is for you, critical thinkers out there, do you think the second in command already had orders from higher up around General Ham? Do you think that the person that General Ham works for as head of AFRICOM, he probably works directly for the commander in chief, that they knew if American forces were under attack that he would immediately respond to try to save those American forces? He was in the had the ability to do it, had the equipment to do it, had the know-how how to do it. He was a combat general, and he was ready to go anytime. He was not going to let anybody die on his watch. But his second in command received a different set of orders. You watch General Ham. If I tell him to stand down and let Ambassador Stevens die, and he makes a move to save him, you arrest him. And that's exactly what happened. One of the things that makes the U.S. different than other countries is that we are governed by the rule of law. Certain persons who want to take control of the country know these laws, and they know that the military cannot be their enemy. They must follow orders. And when they don't, they can be arrested, like they were still in boot camp. It is the greatest show of courage for a seasoned military leader, notice I did not say manager, to swallow his pride and go peacefully to jail when the Secretary of State orders you to be arrested. They must have been screaming inside their hearts to see those men being killed on camera and being ordered to do nothing about it. It must have been something much more than the tarnishing of a global propaganda campaign by the Obama administration that there's no such thing as Islamic terrorism. It must have been a tremendous secret that was in the possession of Ambassador Stevens hours after he met with the Turkish ambassador that they wanted to die with him. Perhaps it pertained to the thousands of missiles and rockets and chemicals that were now on the open market with the very recent assassination of Muammar Gaddafi. We may never know, as the trail grows quieter every hour. But why? How did the, quote, thorough investigation by the FBI show up at the burned-out U.S. embassy and then left behind the ambassador's personal diary lying on the floor? Yeah, a CNN reporter found it just lying there. Computer disks, files, other classified information was there for anyone to see, but the FBI didn't touch a thing. The diary, instead of being handed over to congressional investigators, well, it was returned to the family. If I was a family member, I would want the people responsible for this murder to be brought to justice. The men who perpetrated this violence walk free to this day. We see them every day. They have been identified, and they could be apprehended at any time. But the administration still has the order to stand down in place. Nothing is to be done with these people. I recall that President Kennedy made a speech that warned us about this very thing happening at this very level of conflict between those who would tell the truth and uphold the Constitution and those who want a secret to die with the holder of that secret. And remember, Ambassador Stevens did not just die. He was brutalized in the Islamic style of humiliation and left to die. He suffered greatly throughout the whole ordeal because they did not just want him to die. They wanted him to suffer. Let's listen to this president. Play the clip of President Kennedy, please.
Now, 6 months after the attacks in Benghazi, lawmakers fuming they have not been allowed to speak to any of the American survivors. That story takes on a new urgency after Secretary of State John Kerry confirming with our own James Rosen that he, Secretary Kerry, visited a survivor still recovering at Walter Reed Hospital in Washington. Here's Republican Congressman.
Sorry, we had to do this because I'm having technical problems on my own laptop here. Here we go.
Ladies and gentlemen, the very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society. And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings. We decided long ago that the dangers of excessive and unwarranted concealment of pertinent facts far outweighed the dangers which are cited to justify it. Even today, there is little value in opposing the threat of a closed society by imitating its arbitrary restrictions. Even today, there is little value in ensuring the survival of our nation if our traditions do not survive with it. And there is very grave danger that an announced need for increased security will be seized upon by those anxious to expand its meaning to the very limits of official censorship and concealment. That I do not intend to permit to the extent that it's in my control. And no official of my administration, whether his rank is high or low, civilian or military, should interpret my words here tonight as an excuse to censor the news, to stifle dissent, to cover up our mistakes, or to withhold from the press and the public the facts they deserve to know. For we are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that relies primarily on covert means for expanding its sphere of influence, on infiltration instead of invasion, on subversion instead of elections, on intimidation instead of free choice, on guerrillas by night instead of armies by day. It is a system which has conscripted vast human and material resources into the building of a tightly knit, highly efficient machine that combines military, diplomatic, intelligence, economic, scientific, and political operations. Its preparations are concealed, not published. Its mistakes are buried, not headlined. Its dissenters are silenced, not praised. No expenditure is questioned, no rumor is printed, no secret is revealed. No president should fear public scrutiny of his program, for from that scrutiny comes understanding, and from that understanding comes support or opposition, and both are necessary. I am not asking your newspapers to support an administration, but I am asking your help in the tremendous task of informing and alerting the American people. For I have complete confidence in the response and dedication of our citizens whenever they are fully informed. I not only could not stifle controversy among your readers, I welcome it. This administration intends to be candid about its errors. For as a wise man once said, an error doesn't become a mistake until you refuse to correct it. We intend to accept full responsibility for our errors, and we expect you to point them out when we miss them. Without debate, without criticism, no administration and no country can succeed, and no republic can survive. That is why the Athenian lawmaker Solon decreed it a crime for any citizen to shrink from controversy. And that is why our press was protected by the First Amendment, the only business in America specifically protected by the Constitution, not primarily to amuse and entertain, not to emphasize the trivial and the sentimental, not to simply give the public what it wants, but to inform, to arouse, to reflect, to state our dangers and our opportunities, to indicate our crises and our choices, to lead, mold, educate, and sometimes even anger public opinion. This means greater coverage and analysis of international news, for it is no longer far away and foreign, but close at hand and local. It means greater attention to improved understanding of the news, as well as improved transmission. And it means, finally, that government at all levels must meet its obligation to provide you with the fullest possible information outside the narrowest limits of national security. And so it is to the printing press, to the recorder of man's deeds, the keeper of his conscience, the courier of his news, that we look for strength and assistance, confident that with your help, man will be what he was born to be, free and independent.
So, shall we be free and independent? And then this week, 6 days before the end of the 8th month after Benghazi, as our elected lawmakers struggle against the secret society of this administration, you can hear the frustration. You can sense the conflict between Congress, battered on a daily basis by the president and his global press corps proliferation, pushing his propaganda, and the president, who would rather golf than worry about the economy or the safety and honor of this nation. You can see the rising fever of resent and anger between the military and its own commander-in-chief. All right, so let's play this one. This is the Fox News one, and this is today. This is today. You're going to hear the frustration of what Congress is seeing with this supposedly wide open and cooperating administration. Play the clip.
Now, 6 months after the attacks in Benghazi, lawmakers fuming they have not been allowed to speak to any of the American survivors. That story takes on a new urgency after Secretary of State John Kerry confirming with our own James Rosen that he, Secretary Kerry, visited a survivor still recovering at Walter Reed Hospital in Washington. Here's Republican Congressman Ed Royce, chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, on this.
That is absolutely unbelievable that we in the United States could not obtain access to those who participated in this, who had knowledge about it, and that is being blocked. And we want answers as to why we cannot obtain the facts and interview those who had a hand in this. Okay. And why they're not brought to justice.
That with Brett last night in Special Report. With us now, Republican Congressman Jason Chaffetz on the Judiciary and Oversight Committee in the House. Sir, good morning to you and welcome back here to America's News. I just want to get a baseline of knowledge here. How have you tried to reach out to these survivors who are now back stateside?
Well, I went to Libya shortly after the attack. I was able to visit with just a handful of people, but a lot of them I was not able to talk with. So I've been trying to do this for the last 6 months. We know that some people were interviewed in Tripoli. We know that some went on to Germany. Some were injured. Some were interviewed there. We have at least one person from the State Department who is still in recovery at a hospital 6 months after the fact. I appreciate that Secretary Kerry went there. But they will not give us the names. In fact, we've been told that one of the people who actually went to the hospital had their name changed on the hospital records, so we can't even find them.
Now, why would they not give you the names?
I don't know, Bill.
Be a reason why they're trying to protect these people from something or somebody like you. What do you think?
That's why it causes so many questions, because we are now in our eighth tranche of documents. It's still just a couple of weeks ago. They're still giving us documents. It's 6 months after the fact. We still have whistleblowers who will provide us information. They won't allow us access to the materials that the Accountability Review Board looked at. We would like to do. We'd like to talk to the Accountability Review Board. They don't want to do that. We want to talk to the survivors. They won't do that. And then the president has the gall to go on television and say, oh, we're providing all the access. Baloney, bull crap. That is not happening.
How many are there survivors? I've heard a dozen.
I don't even know. I don't even have a full list. And when they go to the hospital and they change their name, you're going to have lawmakers like myself who are going to go out there and continue to pound on the desk and say, Mr. President, the White House, Mr. Secretary, provide us this information. We're not going to let go of this until we get to the bottom of it.
All right. Now, you wonder about the condition of these survivors. Are they able to talk? Are they still recovering from injuries? Do you have that answer?
Secretary Kerry said that he went and spoke with them. And again, this is just one individual. We have more than a dozen people that were engaged in this. We think we should be able to talk to them. Look, we got four dead Americans. We got hundreds of embassies, thousands of people serving overseas. We want to understand what helped cause this and how do we prevent it in the future. That's the whole goal.
All right, I'm reading something here that Fox News has learned that the House Intelligence Committee and some of its members will be able to see some of the talking points that were circulated back in September. What do you know about that?
I know that the Senate, particularly Lindsey Graham, has been tenacious on this. They have some documents as well. But again, this begs the question, why won't the State Department just give us what we requested? And we're getting to the point, Bill, where we're going to be left with no choice except to issue a subpoena. We don't want to do that, but we're 6 months into this and we don't have the
answer. Let me come back to the subpoena. But if you had the talking points from September, how would that change the story, do you believe?
Well, I think we need to find out what led up to the attacks and how do we prevent that in the future, what went down in those 25 hours during the attack, and then afterwards, how the administration misled the American people and the world.
I think those are
three big buckets.
Why have you not issued a subpoena? I mean, obviously you're frustrated. You're getting nowhere at this point based on your current tactic. Why not go subpoena?
Look, if it was unilaterally left up to me, I would do that, and I would have done it months ago. But I don't make those decisions. I'm working closely with Chairman Issa, with the Speaker's office, but they've been, I think, exceptionally beyond patient. There comes a point where you just say, look, we've been polite, we've been nice, we're just not getting the answers. In fact, we continue to get the runaround.
Well, I'm assuming you've expressed that to committee heads on this, right?
Yeah. Yes, I can.
What would you expect to learn from the survivors if and when you get the opportunity to talk to them?
Well,
what's your first question?
What happened? What kind of communication? Did you ask for air support? I really worry that once we did have injured, we did have dead bodies, the extraction of those people back out of Benghazi. Look, when a plane landed in Benghazi, we had injured people. That plane didn't go to Italy, which was the shortest route. It went back to Tripoli. We had evacuated our embassy in Tripoli. Why in the world did that plane take you to Tripoli and then didn't get you back to Germany until 10 p.m. that night? I mean, there's so many things we want to learn about the warnings, about what happened on the getting them out of there. And then how do we find the perpetrators?
Yeah. Listen, we want to bring you back, and we'll be in touch with others, too.
Okay. That's how frustrated Congress is right now. You don't hear Congress say the word bullcrap very often, and I'm sure that wasn't the word he wanted to say, but he was on TV. There's no solution in this. There's no future in this. There will be a schism between the branches of government that was foreseen by the founders. Those who receive a cash benefit from the president will not speak out against him. Right now, 64% of the nation depends upon the president for their daily bread. 54% of the people want nothing to change. They lack the cash. The rest of America wants to work for their own living and wants to earn their way with dignity. The scriptures say that when the more part of the people choose unrighteousness, then cometh destruction. I have always said we could choose another future, and we still can. We could choose to walk away from Armageddon still. But if you say nothing and do nothing, then you will be carried in the wagons by those who are marching right down the middle of the valley of the shadow of death. They do not fear evil because their bellies are full, and they did not have to do a single thing in return except vote for the man behind the wagon train ordering the masses into the battlefield. We must resist the temptation to follow orders and to relinquish our freedoms for a bowl of pottage. There is no king of the United States. There's only a republic that can survive. The difference is that with the latter, we are represented and protected. With the kingdom, we are fed to the enemy, and we are not represented. We are ruled over. Are we subjects or citizens? If you are a recent immigrant to the United States, you are being promised amnesty as a path to citizenship. Do you know that service in the U.S. military is part of that pathway? Are you ready to be cannon fodder for the king? Are you ready to feed your sons and daughters to the military machine? Obama was speaking to graduates of the graduating class of the Ohio State University at Ohio Stadium today. Here's what he said. Unfortunately, you've grown up hearing voices that incessantly warn of government as nothing more than some separate sinister entity that's at the root of all our problems. Some of these same voices also do their best to gum up the works. They'll warn that tyranny always lurking just around the corner. You should reject these voices. because what they suggest is that our brave and creative and unique experiment in self-rule is somehow just a sham with which we can't be trusted. We have never been a people who place all our faith in government to solve our problems. We shouldn't want to. But we don't think the government is the source of all our problems either, because we understand that this democracy is ours. And as citizens, we understand that it's not about what America can do for us. It's about what can be done by us together through the hard and frustrating but absolutely necessary work of self-government. And class of 2013, you have to be involved in that process. Now, that's what he said. That's quite a bit different than President Reagan saying government is the problem. That's different than what you heard Kennedy say of the secret societies, secret deals, backroom oaths and promises that are made. Government is the problem. Government is the problem. It is the root of all of our problems right now, and we need to work it out. There's more evidence of this. We've got about 13 minutes left. I think I can get this in. Because I've just kind of sat back and watched about this and haven't made any comments about this on the program up until now. But I'm going to make comments now because I've got enough information I can speak intelligently about it. And that's the Tamerlan Tsarnaev cause of death. Now, suspected Boston bomber Tamerlan Tsarnaev remains were released to his family on Thursday of this week, and his cause of death was released Friday. I found this most interesting. Peter Steffen, the owner of the Worcester Mass Funeral Home that will handle the arrangements, read Tsarnaev's death certificate to the press. This is how Tamerlan died. The time of death was at 1:35 a.m. on April 19th, and the cause was gunshot wounds and blunt trauma, the result of a shootout with police and his brother running him over. Now, that's what he read. And that's what I heard on the news. That's what you heard on the news. But my question is this. The first picture I saw, and I suspect you saw it as well, was that Tamerlan, now this is the older brother, not the one in the boat, this is the one that was arrested first, was in custody. His hands were bound behind his back, and he was naked, and he was walking. The nude shot I saw, and I have on my computer, of him, showed his completely frontal body without a single mark on it. Of course, his private parts were blurred out, but he didn't have a scratch on him. And there were armored officers on either side of him, and he was walking without any problems. The next thing we hear is that his little brother had struck him with a stolen car and dragged him 40 feet. Somewhere in that event, he was shot as well. Now, I've heard this reported a dozen times from nearly every form of media, but not one single person, not one reporter, not one crew asked this simple question, and I'm going to ask it. Who told us that Tamerlan was run over by his brother? What evidence is there that this actually occurred? Did we hear from any of the police officers who were there? No. Did we have any video of the arrest or the events surrounding the alleged hit and run? No. How does a speeding vehicle run over a man who is in custody, handcuffed, and surrounded by armored police officers and not injure a single police officer? Why is it that the only the man who was in custody got injured? I mean, did the officers toss Tamerlan into the path of the vehicle while driving, you know, diving off to the side either way without a scratch? Do you hear any officers say, "Wow, that was close. I nearly got run over myself"? No. Did they fire at the vehicle as it was bearing down on them at 1:30 a.m. in the morning? No. You've seen the pictures of Tamerlan's body, right? head all banged up, gaping wound on his left rib cage, bullet holes in the upper chest area. Who shot him? And why? He was in custody and without a mark on his naked body in one picture. And in the next, he looks like he was dragged from the trenches of World War I. Now, the other question remains unanswered about a picture which I have seen at least 100 times virally. The Israeli-looking agent with the exact backpack that exploded, strapped to his back before the explosion and then missing after the explosion. Who is this man? Where is this man? Why was he wearing the backpack that was recovered after it exploded? And here are the final questions. Why was the Department of Homeland Security conducting a drill to simulate a bomb being placed near the finish line of the Boston Marathon at the exact date and time that two bombs were left at the finish line of the Boston Marathon? Why did the dogs not pick up the smell of the ammonium nitrate in the vicinity? Why would two young foreign kids change their original July 4th plans of bombing New York City and place two bombs in the midst of hundreds of federal agents with bomb-sniffing dogs in broad daylight during a drill designed to catch two guys just like them? They could have detonated these bombs by phone from anywhere on Earth. They could have blown these bombs up from Miami if they wanted to. Why were they standing a few yards away when they went off? I heard the reporter say that the younger brother dialed up one of the bombs on his cell phone and then it went off. If these boys are smart enough to make these bombs, why wouldn't they have been smart enough to simply walk 6 or 7 blocks away and then call the bomb up? This is why you listen to X Squared Radio, Earth Explorers, because we ask the questions reporters should be asking. Perhaps it takes a scientific mind to see past the obvious. But why are not people asking these questions? These are questions a reporter should ask. Even among online blog news, I have not seen these critical questions. If we had someone out there asking these questions, the evil ones would run for the dark corners and stay there. That's what I'm saying. I just want you to keep your eyes open. I want you to listen carefully because you're being fed. You're being fed a news story from a very well orchestrated and rehearsed press. I don't care if you're listening to Rush Limbaugh or Sean Hannity, or you're listening to Bill O'Reilly, or you're listening to Rachel Maddow. It doesn't matter. They're all saying exactly the same thing. Tamerlan was run over by his younger brother. Well, in the words of Congressman, bull crap. I'm not buying it, and you shouldn't either. So keep your eyes open, and remember, the Republic is ours. If you're not represented in Washington, make a change. 2014's coming up quick. We can turn this around. We have time to save the Republic. Pick up your copy of Alienated Nation. If you haven't read it, read it. And if you're not a great reader, don't worry about it. I read it for you. Go to alienatednation.com and you'll get the audio version for free when you buy the paperback. And buy two of them and send one of them to your governor because it calls for a constitutional convention. We're out of time, folks. I'll see you next week. Right here on X Squared Radio. Remember to help the good in others grow a little bit every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. Remember, you are source.